Hello, everybody. My name is Jeremy Swenson. I am the founder and CEO of Abstract Forward Consulting. We are a consulting company that focuses on putting abstract forward thinking first as we solution security and technology and related problems for our clients. The Abstract Forward Consulting podcast is a show where we interview security, technology, and business leaders. We also interview top pen testers, consultants, toolmakers, and other innovative commentators. Our goal is to shine a light on the tactics, tools, and strategy that will improve security and operational efficiency, breaking the corporate bureaucratic status quo. Today's episode, episode number 11, is going to cover a topic that's trending lately. That is cryptocurrency. It's all the buzz in all types of media, from Pinterest to Instagram to Facebook to C-SPAN to CNN to Fox News to your grandma's dinner table and more. We are going to talk to two experts with really interesting backgrounds. We're going to talk to Brooks Clifford, who is an esteemed marketing technology entrepreneur, a former financial advisor at Morgan Stanley, and a cryptocurrency enthusiast and entrepreneur. We are also going to talk to Josh McIntyre, who is a big tech consultant and is a educational content provider around cryptocurrency, scam avoidance, best practices. And he has a YouTube channel where he puts his content.
Chaintubes.com? Blockchain tutorials.
Is where you can find great video tutorial content on how to avoid cryptocurrency scams, how to get your crypto unlocked, potentially, chaintoots.com. All right. That being said, I would like to give my two esteemed guests an opportunity to introduce themselves, starting with Brooks Clifford.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. For those that don't know me, my name is Brooks Clifford, and I'm here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I run a company called Bidwell Investment Group, and we're a relatively new company. We're in the business of helping people invest in cryptocurrencies, and we currently offer a product that is a fund that offers a diversified pool of cryptocurrencies. So we actively manage that, and I spend a majority of my time researching crypto projects and just trying to be at the forefront of what's going on from the news cycle point of view. So thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Brooks. Where did you go to college?
I went to school at James Madison University, which is out in Virginia. And I went to their College of Business and actually got a degree in marketing. So, yeah, I had, I tell people, so my mom was in marketing for her whole career and my dad was in finance. So I had interest in both of those growing up and was really kind of on the fence of whether to study finance or marketing at school. Chose marketing and did that for a while, but eventually found myself working in finance.
Side note, I've seen some YouTube videos of convocation at that very university. Yeah. And they're pretty good. I know that that university brings in some top-notch speakers for sure. Josh, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Well, first off, thanks very much for having me, Jeremy, and thanks, Brooks, for being here too. So I'm Josh McIntyre. I'm a software engineer by trade. I work for Microsoft during the day. And on the side, I really like to consider myself a passionate learner and explainer. So my personal project called Chaintoots seeks to provide just information on this really new and fascinating technology of cryptocurrencies, how they work, why people might find them useful in their day-to-day lives, and most importantly, how to use this very powerful technology in a way that's safe and avoid scams, security issues, all of the sort of pitfalls that come with a really powerful and useful technology.
And what university did you go to?
I went to St. Vincent College in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, my lovely hometown. It's a great liberal arts school with a thriving computer science program. So that's where I got my start and worked my way up from there.
Awesome. Totally awesome. Well, I want to talk now about scams, hacks, and theft via cryptocurrency generally, because it's been trending in the media. We've heard about this $600 million hack, and then apparently retraction of the hack. And then there's also a $90 million theft that has been reported upon recently. But I guess I would go to you on this question, Josh, since you're producing content and researching some of the common scams. In your mind, what are the common scams that you see in crypto, and what are sort of the ways to avoid those scams?
There's a couple major classes of scams that I really try to warn people about. But before you can even really talk about what kinds of scams you see in cryptocurrency, you need to talk about why scammers use cryptocurrency. And the biggest reason for that is, unlike in traditional finance, cryptocurrency payments are irreversible. So if I send Bitcoin or Ethereum or Bitcoin Cash or Litecoin to you or Brooks, that payment cannot be reversed once it's recorded on the blockchain and has a couple of confirmations. Cryptocurrencies are also by nature global and open, so you don't need a money transfer intermediary like a PayPal or a bank to make a crypto payment. So even though that makes it a really powerful and useful and very open piece of tech, that opens the door for people to use it maliciously.
Yeah.
In terms of the really common classes of scams that I see, there's really a couple major things. I recently had the privilege of talking about some of the most common security pitfalls in crypto at this year's DEF CON Hacker Conference. So the first is really any kind of social engineering-based crypto scams. Most commonly, what you'll see are things like a scammer impersonating a celebrity or a prominent person in cryptocurrency, and in some way or another, trying to trick you into just making a payment to their crypto address. So somebody on Instagram pretends to be Andreas Antonopoulos or Elon Musk, and in some way offers a double your money back, or leads you to a legit looking but fake investment website. And all they're trying to do is socially engineer you into sending them cryptocurrency, just making a normal crypto payment to their address. Because for that reason, once you make that payment, they can just take the money and run. It's not like a wire transfer or a credit card payment where there is a chargeback or a kind of clawback mechanism.
One other thing on the wire transfer and credit cards in the traditional finance space is there is established consumer protection laws around that. So you have the right to dispute a transaction, and there's regulatory authorities that mandate certain time frame and investigation around that. So, and then there's the FDIC insurance for, money deposited in a true deposit account. You know, you're insured up to a certain amount. I believe it's $250,000. Now, don't quote me on that. It's not financial advice, but crypto is different because that regulatory scheme is not around it. And the regulations are emerging and confusing. And there's a lot of different countries that have their hands in cryptocurrencies. And the other thing here is that many of these cryptocurrency exchanges, which are facilitating, the transactions, are in countries outside of the United States. And I guess I'd like to take it over to Brooks now and just talk about, what have you seen related to what Josh is saying about these type of impersonation or social engineering scams? And then we'll come back to you, Josh, and talk about how do you mitigate, respond to.
I think the best thing I can add was before we went on the podcast here, Josh and I were talking a little bit beforehand, and I was telling him a story about how someone was trying to social engineer me into giving them a private key. And, after being in the space for 7-8 years, it was at a different angle than what I had seen before. And enough red flags went off that it was like something didn't feel right. So I kind of knew to not go any further with it. But the point is, like, they're sophisticated. And as you said, Josh, these are professional con artists that do this for a living. So they're quite good at it. And, some of these, I have a lot of friends in crypto, and, some of the times you see some of these scams and they seem so simplistic and really kind of so stupid. But then it's also like I say, the reason you see them all the time is because they obviously work. If they didn't work, these people wouldn't be doing them. And yet we see them all the time in crypto after years. And so that just proves they're obviously getting a return on their time, those that are committing the scams.
That's something I often talk about too, especially not only when I'm talking to newcomers to the crypto space that aren't technical, but also when I'm talking to people in our industry and in this space that have experience, is it's a very double-edged sword. On one hand, using a very powerful technology like this, users have a responsibility to themselves to learn how to use the technology safely. There is no, you know, bumpers. There's no safety net for you as the cryptocurrency user as there is in banking. On the other hand, I think that there's somewhat of a bad tendency for the technical folks in the crypto space to always just blame the victim and not build better user experiences around crypto security. I think we, as the technical folks in the space and the experienced folks in the space, need to do a better job of making newcomers aware of exactly what these kind of scams look like and the sort of best practices that they can follow to avoid them. It takes multiple people to make the experience more safe. Mm-hmm. The reality is, Jeremy, to your point about regulations, is not only are these regulations not here yet for crypto, but they're sort of against the ethos of crypto in the first place. What cryptocurrency technology is trying to do is to provide a truly decentralized way to transfer value between people. It's totally global. You can send money to anyone anywhere in the world at any time. And we don't want those payments to be stoppable. The reason that Bitcoin emerged is the idea that I should be able to send money to anyone anywhere without having to trust an intermediary. And so if there's really no way to build safeguards into that, the core of the protocols that we use, it's more around exchanges and user experiences and the way that we can kind of warn people to avoid these things.
Yeah, great thoughts there. I want to ask another question, and this is not really a scam question, but this is really it's one of the gaps of the user experience of cryptocurrency generally, and that is that there's a high percentage of people who've lost cryptocurrency and they can't get it back. And I don't know what this percentage is. Maybe one of you two can give a number or ask range of where the percentage is of people who've lost their cryptocurrency and it's just sitting out there because they lost their key or something like that happened and they can't get it back. So from a design and a user experience standpoint, that's a flaw. That's one way you can view it. A traditional financial product wouldn't allow for you to lose your credit card payment and not be able to get it back. You know, you have a way to dispute that. You can contact the vendor. You can contact the merchant processor. You can contact the regulatory agency, the state level, federal level, and get some sort of, you know, response on that. But if either you two could just talk about this user experience design problem, this is how I'm describing it. Maybe you don't see it as a problem, but let's just say if it's 10 or 20% of all cryptocurrency is locked up, to me, that's an issue and that's a concern. In your guys' experience, what are some considerations with that?
Yeah, I would say the biggest issue is one of wallet user experience and user interface. At the core protocol level, all that you need to make a Bitcoin payment is you need your private key to sign a transaction and the receiver's public address. And by design, those payments cannot be stopped by some sort of regulator, and the payments are not reversible. So what I think needs to improve in the industry is when you are using an exchange or you're using a non-custodial wallet piece of software where you hold the private keys, it should have some common sense warnings right there before you send a payment. Make sure that this address is correct. Double, triple check it. Make sure this is your intended recipient and intended cryptocurrency. You know, don't mix up Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash or other sorts of forks. And warn people that, hey, once you send this payment, there's no getting it back, so make sure everything is right. That's really not a perfect solution, right? I mean, people are always going to fall through the cracks. But because of the nature of how cryptocurrency protocols are designed, you really can't add in too many more safeguards other than education, which is why I kind of do what I do. Brooks, did you have any thoughts on this?
Well, first, I've experienced multiple friends or people that I know that I got into crypto that have lost coins. So it is a real problem. And in terms of, you know, I take back to calling it the word a problem, because Jeremy, you mentioned, or you kind of addressed it specifically, calling it a problem. I don't necessarily look at it as a problem, so to speak. I would compare it more to owning something, say, like gold, for example, where if you have gold and you want to actually own physical gold, you have a responsibility of figuring out how to safely store the gold. And if you're one of those people that wants to literally dig a hole in your backyard and bury it in the ground, but then you forget where you buried it, that's on you for forgetting where you buried it. I don't necessarily say that that's a flaw of gold, that if somebody loses it, they can't recover it. Now, I understand if you're comparing it more to like a credit card transaction with the ability for a reversal if something goes awry, that's a little bit different. But, you know, that's where Bitcoin and cryptos get a little confusing, is they're kind of this hybrid of talking about, you know, some of the values of currencies and exchanging things through intermediaries like PayPal or Venmo that can reverse things. But then it also has characteristics of a commodity like gold or silver, where it's like, you know, if you go buy $10,000 worth of gold, it's on you to remember where you put your gold. So, you know, and I feel bad for people that have lost crypto. I mean, I've firsthandedly tried to help people figure out how to recover crypto that's lost. And it's been things like they create a complex password and then they don't remember it. Like somebody that has the same password for every login, which is like a very traditional characteristic of human nature, you use the same password or some variation of it for like every password. And then when I get people into crypto, I'm like, you should really use, you know, a good password for this. They'll create a password that they never use for anything else. And I emphasize you have to write it down on a piece of paper and laminate that paper, or, you know, figure out a way to safeguard the paper and also make multiple copies of it. And people are just lazy and don't do all that. And then they don't, you know, then something goes awry years later and they forget about setting things up properly, you know, when they first get in. So I don't know. It's just a characteristic of crypto is properly storing it. And, you know, something I'll say real quick too, which is interesting. You can probably both appreciate the phrase of not your keys, not your crypto. So I've always preached from the time I got into crypto, you want to get your crypto off exchanges and into cold storage. And that comes from a history of being in crypto at a time where exchanges were not trustworthy, where I think today in 2021, you can safely keep your coins stored at Coinbase. Now there's still risks involved in terms of like, hey, the government could just freeze Coinbase one day and just say, no money's coming in, no money's coming out. And so Coinbase maybe won't take your money, but there's still risks to it. But what I was going to get at here with all that was more people today keep their crypto stored on exchanges than they did when I got into crypto 8 years ago, when it was a problem in crypto when I got into it. It was like, hey, people are being lazy and not taking the proper steps to securing their crypto. And I got on that bandwagon pretty quickly and tried to preach to people proper crypto storage and not your keys, not your crypto. And yet here we are like 8 years later and the problem's worse today than it was back when I got into crypto. And it's just like a crazy amount of crypto is stored on exchanges. So, but it's like a safety versus convenience spectrum. People like convenience. So
people are used to the security being on the financial institution, not on them. So if you have accounts with Wells Fargo, or Charles Schwab or any other traditional financial institution, you worry about just, you know, being able to log into that. But anything that happens to that, you don't worry about that.
Right.
They're going to take care of that. They have people for that. With crypto, it's like you said, the gold analogy. You know, you're responsible for where you put your gold, what you do with your gold, and, you know, be prudent with your gold. I think that's a fair analogy. It's a fair point. It's a complex topic. I can imagine some sort of hybrid new crypto product that would solve for this somewhat, while still having the lack of, you know, a central authority. I know that's a hard design use case to imagine, but I think more research needs to be done on, you know, what happens with this crypto that's locked up. I mean, does somebody who has the backdoor keys that nobody knows about, do they take this, or kind of what happens to it? Because I think a lot of people wonder, you know, if it's 10 or 20% of all cryptocurrency is locked up, what happens to it? Where does it go? You know, because I know enough about psychology and people to know that people would want to get at that, you know. So it's an interesting topic, and it's complex, and it's early in this space. So I guess what I'm saying is I see new exchanges and new cryptocurrency that can better address this dilemma really taking off, and ones that can't. And I understand the design point that you guys making, that is irreversible in that there's no central authority, but maybe there could be a hybrid model of it, which would have wider mass market adoption, particularly to people who are less savvy than you two. What do you think about that, Josh?
Well, to answer your question about where the crypto goes, because it's a very fascinating sort of thing, it is gone forever. It truly is. There is no backdoor key. And the reason for this is... Bitcoin private keys, without getting too deep into the technical weeds, are 256 bit keys. That means that, stored in the computer, 256 bits of randomly generated information. In order to try to guess that key, there is not enough time nor energy in the solar system to go through all the possible guesses, right? So if you have a four-digit PIN code for your phone, there's 10,000 possible guesses. The amount of possible guesses that you would have to try for to get a Bitcoin private key is believed to be more than the number of atoms in the known universe. Just a number that we cannot even fathom as human beings. So that goes to Brooks' point, and a point that I try to touch on a lot is you must make good backups of your private keys. If your wallet is properly generating your Bitcoin keys that you're going to lock up your crypto in, through your addresses, you need to make solid backups of that. You need a couple backups. You need them in a couple safe places. And there are some different technologies out there for doing this. One thing that's become relatively popular is even engraving a representation of your private keys. They're called most wallets these days give you what's called a mnemonic. It's 12 to 24 randomly generated English words that like represent all of your Bitcoin keys. A lot of people have taken to actually engraving those in metal so that if their house burns down, and there's a really high temperature fire, their laminated paper with their Bitcoin keys doesn't just burn up. You know, getting into a lot of different things there, sort of off of that question. Lost crypto is truly lost. No one, if you got all of the world's supercomputers to do nothing but crunch numbers on the problem of recovering lost Bitcoin, provided that those keys were properly generated in the first place, you could never find them before the Earth gets absorbed by the sun. The math is that big.
Gets at quantum computing and big data and things like that. I just want to say one thing in response to what you brought up there, Josh, and that is there are cases where the FBI or the NSA has gone in, and I don't know the technical details of how they've done this, but if we just take the gas pipeline hack, right? So there was a ransomware demanded. And we didn't even get to ransomware. So I think we should go to ransomware right now, because there's a correlation between ransomware and crypto, right? But so for this gas pipeline hack, the FBI and other government agencies, which we don't have the classified information on that, obviously, but there was a public release, and they are saying they were able to get some of it back. Now, I don't recall how much they got back, but I think it was in the neighborhood of 20% to a third. So those scenarios do exist. Obviously, the resources of government, I think it has to do with the exchange and at what the exchange has access to. And they may have been monitoring something ahead of time. I don't know the details to really be offer much more than that. But that's an interesting caveat to the point that you made, is that, you know, the authorities can, in extreme cases, recover it. You just wonder how. And were they in ahead of time?
What I had heard about that particular case was that the attackers actually left the stolen coins in what we call a hot wallet. And all a hot wallet means is it's a wallet where the private keys are stored on some kind of online device. So quickly, a hot wallet would be, I installed the Coinomi or Bitcoin.com wallet on my mobile phone, and the keys are stored encrypted on that device. A cold wallet or offline storage is, I generated keys on a specialized device like a Ledger or a KeepKey hardware wallet, and I keep those keys completely offline. They never touch a network. So essentially what happened in this case is the thief stole a car and they left the key in the wheel well or under the gas cap. It would be a good analogy. The other way that stolen cryptocurrency is often recovered is exactly what you said, Jeremy, which is through exchanges. Most thieves of cryptocurrency don't want to keep the cryptocurrency. They're not long-term Bitcoin hodlers. They want to get the money, use this irreversible payment mechanism, and then get their local currency. In order to do that, they have to go through an exchange, which is a centralized institution that offers the service of trading cryptocurrency. So you can use blockchain analytics to track the coins moving into a central institution and then seize that account through traditional law enforcement means like a warrant. And, you know, no company wants to launder money for thieves generally.
Yeah, the other thing that they're doing at the exchanges is, and this kind of gets at the traditional banking anti-money laundering type of approach, they are doing some monitoring for suspicious activity. And for high dollar amount type transactions, you know, on the traditional bank side, for example, if it's a certain dollar amount, if it's over, say, you know, $5 million, there will be a time hold on it, and there will be an extra due diligence. So $5 million out isn't going to be as fast necessarily as, you know, $100 out. There needs to be an additional compliance check on that. And they also have, I mean, the big banks have analytics, data analytics on all this. So and they're subscribing to vendor analytical tools, which are giving them dark information. You know what I mean? If you're on the Terra watch list, or, you know, if you're prohibited, mm-hmm. you know, from if it's from a prohibited country, you know what I mean? Like from Iran or something like that, or North Korea, those type of things. So it's much more messy and not defined for crypto. But I think the crypto exchanges are what they're trying to do, especially the ones that are headquartered here in the US, like Coinbase. What they're trying to do is they're trying to have that spirit of anti-money laundering, compliance, know your customer. And so to that end, they have policies, procedures that they have drafted, and that may annoy some customers, because you may want to, you know, sell and move your money in a certain time frame, and that gets delayed, not necessarily the selling of your coin, but when the actual money gets moved, because I know the exchanges have rules where you can only move a certain amount of money per day. And you can only deposit a certain amount of money per day. And I've got accounts on a few different exchanges. And I think one of the strategies in crypto is to use multiple exchanges. You know what I mean? In case one of them has issues and they're in different countries. Binance is really huge and has been trending a lot lately. So let's just talk a little bit about, I know I said we were going to talk about ransomware. We'll come back to that. But I want to talk about exchanges. And I want to take this one to you, Josh. Just talk about three exchanges, some of the differences, maybe Binance, Coinbase, Robinhood, because those are three pretty different, particularly Robinhood. So just walk us through, for those in the audience who really don't know much about exchanges, kind of what they are, what the pros and cons are.
Yeah, I have personal experience with Coinbase. So there's kind of a – Coinbase and Binance are very similar in how they operate. But there is quite a difference in the way that Coinbase and Robinhood or PayPal crypto offerings operates. Traditionally, what a cryptocurrency exchange is it's a platform that allows you to buy and sell different cryptocurrencies to and from other cryptocurrencies or to what we in the industry often call fiat, which is like normal money, right? US dollars, euro, those sorts of things. So generally for someone like me, right, I don't get paid in cryptocurrency for my day job. I do sometimes get paid in cryptocurrency through my side consulting work. And so, you know, I have a need sometimes to go back and forth between the two. I want to buy some Bitcoin Cash so I can then use it to buy goods and services online. Or I get paid in Bitcoin and I want to cash some of that out to use it for something. So exchanges store the money that you're actively trading with them, right? Your active crypto deposits in their custody. So you don't have access to the private keys that we were talking about earlier. And that's the big distinction between an exchange and a normal crypto wallet. Is a normal crypto wallet, what we call non-custodial, gives you direct access to the keys, which means you, the user, are in full control of your money. Nobody else can seize it or do anything else with it, which is what makes crypto appealing. But an exchange offers more convenience in the sense that if you have some Bitcoin on there, it's on their security people to keep it safe. That hasn't always worked out traditionally, but you know there is that avenue for people that are new and they're used to, I have a strong password and two-factor, but I don't know what to do with Bitcoin keys. Now, the big difference between a Coinbase and a Binance and something like Robinhood or PayPal crypto offering is with Coinbase or Binance, if I go on there and I trade $1,000 for cryptocurrency, I can then send that cryptocurrency on the Bitcoin or Ethereum protocol to a wallet where I hold the private keys. So now it is really mine. Products like Robinhood are currently only giving their users what is essentially price exposure to Bitcoin. If you buy Bitcoin on Robinhood, you cannot transfer that to an external Bitcoin address that you control. You can only buy and sell Bitcoin on there. So really all you're getting is essentially exposure to the price movement of Bitcoin. And those are two very different things.
Right. No fees on Robinhood too, right? That's the other aspect of Robinhood. And Robinhood really is kind of like the mass market crypto exchange, if you will, right? That's kind of how people think of it. It's not for the more advanced traders because Robinhood also doesn't have a lot of coins. There's a lot you cannot get on Robinhood, which is one of the reasons why people like Binance. But, you know, Binance has its own kind of regulatory issues. It's being investigated in a number of countries. They're being sued by different groups.
Well, I'm pretty sure you can't have an account on Binance if you're in the U.S. because they're not a U.S.-based.
Well, no, Binance.us. Binance has versions of Binance. That's one clarification we should make. Yeah, you're right about that. And Binance has been prohibited in some countries. I forget which of the countries, yep. But I think some in Europe, they've been prohibited. And it's up in the air what's going to happen yep. in the U.S. They had their CEO of Binance U.S. was a former, I believe it was the former head of the OCC or another U.S. regulatory financial agency, and he yep. stepped down.
Yeah, they're in a little regulation trouble. but they'll survive. I mean, yeah, but they're just like, they're in just kind of, I would say countries are, you know, they've been operating in a I'll jump in on the topic of the exchange real quick and say there's often in crypto, I say two different types of exchanges, those that are compliant and those that are not compliant. And that to me is like the big difference, because compliant exchanges are like Coinbase that require you to verify yourself and they record your transactions. And I would put those in the category of trustworthy, although trustworthy wouldn't necessarily still keep my money stored on them. But in terms of actually using them, they're a legitimate company. I mean, obviously Coinbase is publicly traded at this point in time. So like they're a legitimate company. But then you have the non-compliant exchanges, like what Binance was doing for many years, which was not asking for any verification information on who you are. Basically, just as long as you have an email address, you can trade crypto on our exchange. And that's kind of what's getting them in hot water now, with a lot of countries banning them, is just saying you can't operate in our country when you're, you know, essentially not verifying what people are doing with their money, which is like pretty understandable. I mean, obviously, like here in the United States, you can't be doing that kind of shenanigans, letting people deposit millions of dollars of crypto on your exchange and then trading it and then withdrawing it all and not telling you anything about who they are. So, and then with like Robinhood, they are offering, I think like what Josh was saying, I mean, I just call it like derivative crypto. It's paper crypto. The same way you can go on the stock exchange and buy paper gold, you're just buying a piece of paper that follows the price of gold. And if your only like reason for doing it is because you want to capture like upside investment potential, then it actually works for that reason. But what you're not buying, right, the same way when you buy paper gold, you're not actually buying real physical gold that you can hold in your hand. That's essentially what Robinhood's doing with crypto. Because like if you actually buy real Bitcoin, you can put it on a physical storage device or like a paper wallet and physically hold it in your hand and physically have it in your possession. Whereas these paper derivatives are just a number on a computer.
Well said. So now let's get to kind of ransomware. You know, there's a lot of organized crime that has been more aggressive as cloud technologies and analytical technology innovation has enhanced greatly, so that organized crime can be more sophisticated in their digital extortion attempts, otherwise known as ransomware. So organizations of all types, you know, are getting these phishing and smishing emails, very sophisticated, sometimes through social engineering, sometimes not. But the end result is, you know, we talked about the gas pipeline. They're paying some ransomware, but all kinds of industries are getting just hit by this. And this ransomware apparently is working somewhat for the organized crime industry, because they keep doing it. And I think there's a correlation between, you know, the organized crime industry and the cyber insurance industry, because they want to sell more cyber insurance, which this is a really new industry. And, you know, the amount of profit they're making on these policies is, you know, likely very high. But just talk a little bit about what you guys have seen in your time with ransomware and its relationship to cryptocurrency.
I can jump in and tell a quick story, which is I first saw that in 2014. And I got a call from a friend of mine who is, you know, a guy that was probably twice my age, that their company had gotten hit by ransomware and they were demanding Bitcoin as the payment. So this was 2014 and they were asking for like 1.5 Bitcoin, which was like $1,000 basically. And the easiest answer to the situation was we paid the ransom. So the reason he even called me was he was like, "Hey, you're in Bitcoin, right?" And I was like, "Yeah, how can I help you?" He's like, "Well, we need some Bitcoin to pay this dude." So, the story with that was actually paying out the ransomware and just getting access back to his company files again. So, and that was in 2014. And since then, I've had to help other people with that same problem, which is basically you download ransomware, they get access to your files, and you have the choice of either trying to fight them on it or pay the ransomware. So it's an extremely lucrative business for the hackers. I mean, the amount of billions of dollars generated off it every year is insane. But
they have anonymity, yep, largely too. Or they're hiding their identity via several layers, yep, many different VMs and protocols, and that makes it hard to track them down. And then the other thing is the cost, sure, to track them down. Is it even worth it? That, you know, I talked to a certain leader of a company, and he said that his company had the strategy, a business continuity strategy, of having a certain amount of crypto sit somewhere for this very case. And I think a lot of boards are having that same conversation because, you know, from a business continuity and a risk management standpoint, if you're on a board, you know, you're responsible for keeping the business going. And do you have to think of all kinds of, you know, sure, risks, fires, you know, strike, you know, pandemic, you know, ransomware. And then, so what do you do about that? Well, you can have some insurance, sure. But you could also have, you know, a certain amount of cryptocurrency readily available, and many organizations do. And I would say probably most large organizations would never admit that they do, but I would say most large organizations do. And if they do, it might even be through a separate affiliated kind of hidden legal entity where it's there. It's not really associated with them.
See, I would argue that they probably don't. I don't think most large organizations do have a secret stash of Bitcoin. I mean, first of all, they'd have to disclose it, as we've seen with companies that have to buy or want to buy Bitcoin. But most people are not prepared for getting ransomware hit by them. And what I've come to find, if you're a company, the ransomware demand's often like $500 to $1,000. Now, if you're just like an average Joe and your laptop at home, like your 8-year-old laptop gets hit by this and you have no important data on your computer, it's probably not worth paying off. But if you're a company and it gets hit by this, it's like, what's $500 versus losing 2 or 3 days of not having access to your computer system? So it clearly makes sense just to pay it off. But it also depends on how large. I mean, I don't know. It depends. Most of it is done by human error. I mean, that's a start. I'm sure Josh would agree to that point, which is just people do stupid stuff on their computers to get ransomware in the first place. And it just happens to be now in 2021, they demand crypto for it. And, you know, it used to be Bitcoin. And here's to your point, too, about why companies probably don't have this is because the ransomware people are starting to realize that they need to use Monero for the scam because it's even harder to trace than Bitcoin. And there's no way in hell like Target Corporation has like a stash of Monero on hand in case they get cyber hacked.
Well, probably what they have is they have a third party on retainer.
That could be true.
Has it. And they don't have to disclose that third party on retainer has it. And here's the thing: that third party on retainer is set up to be like, sure, fast.
Well, yeah, that
getting that they're ready,
I could
to
understand.
Go like that,
which
like
is just a, like a service. I see. Yes, yes.
Well, what's so interesting about there's two kind of interesting things with ransomware that I think in sort of its involvement with cryptocurrency is one of the points you brought up, Brooks. It's a super common mistake that people make when they call Bitcoin anonymous. Bitcoin is not anonymous in the slightest. It's actually all transfers of Bitcoin are recorded on a public, decentralized and widely shared ledger called the blockchain. And that's how the technology works. What Bitcoin is Bitcoin is pseudonymous, right? It's not I, Josh McIntyre, sent $100 worth of Bitcoin to Brooks Clifford. It's 1AZXY34 address, you know, on and on, sent, transferred to another Bitcoin address. In certain protocols like Bitcoin and Ethereum, it's actually very easy or I shouldn't say easy, but straightforward and technically possible to trace the movement of the stolen funds and trace it back to an exchange. There's sort of technologies like mixing and coin joins that can be used to add a layer of privacy on top of Bitcoin. But Bitcoin, as a native protocol, is not very private at all. Now, other cryptocurrencies like Monero, for example, have a high degree of privacy and anonymity built into the protocol, where you can't easily trace. If I send Brooks or I send Jeremy Monero, it can't easily be traced. The other interesting thing about ransomware, and, you know, I'm not a corporate IT person, I'm a software engineer, right? But one of the technical solutions to ransomware, whether it's on a corporate level or on a personal level, like ransomware on your laptop, is something that has nothing to do with cryptocurrency tech, which is have a backup and have a backup that you've tested, right? A backup isn't a backup unless it's been tested, unless restoring from that backup, returning that data to a usable state has been tested.
Right.
So, you know, the interesting thing about ransomware that strikes me, even though I'm super fascinated with the cryptocurrency aspect of it, right? To me, the cryptocurrency angle is fairly simple. A attacker demands payment in a method of payment that's irreversible and fairly easy to then transfer around and get out of without it being clawed back like a wire transfer. But the thing that fascinates me more as a technology professional is the fact that how many of these major corporations didn't have a tested backup plan where they had to go pay the attacker and then trust that the attacker would actually decrypt their locked data rather than having a solid live backup that they could go back to, or a cold backup from a week ago that wasn't affected by this. That to me is what amazes me more even than the use of crypto.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that point. At all, because that's just, there's so many things just people naturally do wrong with computers. One I mentioned was the universal password for pretty much like all accounts. That's such a common thing I see with people. And another one is people don't properly back up their data. I mean, how many people, if they drop their phone in a bucket of water, like right now, well, I guess a lot of phones now, like Apple phones are backed up to Apple Cloud and Samsung's to Google Cloud, but, again, those are people that are paying somebody else to hold all their data for them. So wouldn't even agree with those principles myself in the first place. But yeah, it's an interesting spectrum.
Yeah. And like, you know, like you said, simple things like the universal password, you know, not to get too far down the all the different technical recommendations. Right. But most people do reuse passwords, and they reuse passwords that aren't hard for attackers to crack if a password hash database is breached, right? I think everyday people, if you have nothing to do with crypto or really anything super technical, should learn how to use a password manager, learn how to use KeePass or LastPass, and generate and store secure passwords. Because all I have to do is remember one password, and then my password manager generates and autofills the rest of them. It just, again, it strikes me that these companies, you know, don't have battle-tested plans for backup and battle-tested plans for security. And it's, that's not to say, wow, I'm sure I could have done it better, right? It's a super hard problem to solve.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to me to think about, I would love to be in the room where they're doing a post-mortem breakdown of what happened.
Sure.
And then deciding on what they could do better.
I can tell you a funny side story real quick that's not at all crypto related. I was just telling this to somebody recently, which is, so I, this is 10 plus years ago, started an online marketing company, Big Red Dog Solutions. And so we built companies' websites and did a lot of their like social media management and online marketing management. So we would get joint access to many of those accounts. And if any of my old clients happen to come upon this video, they might take note of this real quick and check something, which is, I was telling my friend, I'm still connected to like half of my clients' accounts. Like they've never like unconnected me to them. And I'm kind of just lazy and have like not unconnected to them. And some of these are companies that I worked with like 10 years ago. And they're oblivious to the fact that there's a dude in Minnesota that has like access to all their stuff right now. And it's like such a high percentage rate of companies that I've worked with still have, I have access to like all their stuff. And that's years after working with them. And that's part of them just having, I would say, kind of poor processes in place, because even just the process of like turning over accounts and passwords on like a regular basis and checking to see who has access to specific information. I see it all the time. Some people will know the reference I'm talking about. I'm not going to name the company, but a company story amongst some of my friends is they fired somebody recently and they had all the access to their social media channels after getting fired. Like, they forgot to take away the access to social media after they fired an employee that was like super pissed off. So just like use the social media channels to just like create a shit show for the company. And I was like, and it's a tech company. I mean, you'd think they'd have like a process like that 101, like, hey, make sure the employee doesn't have access to these things anymore before you tell them they're fired. And things like that, you know, just happen all the time. I mean, all the time.
That kind of gets at least privilege and need to know access to principles that are really key, meaning that those who have access truly need to have it, and you give people the least privilege needed to do the job, and that's reviewed in a regular frequency. At more mature, larger organizations, that sort of process is standardized. When someone leaves or contractor finishes up, you know, the access is revoked right away. But with multiple systems in different sub areas, it can get complex and messy for sure. And this kind of, this ties into the dilemma that we're in with ransomware, is that some of the hackers and the ransomware architects are pretty innovative. They're smart people and organizations. They're able to essentially backwards engineer the architecture of large sophisticated organizations and governments. And that shows a competency and a skill. And I think organizations can learn from that. Take, you know, every one of these breaches or hacks, an organization can really take an opportunity and examine what happened, do a postmortem, and really learn from that and beef up their defenses and try to mimic and have internal people that are acting like hackers and ransomware extortionists so that they can learn how to better defend from them. I think that's a real key thing. One thing I want to ask both you guys, and then I want to move on to kind of some more current events related to crypto. But one thing I want to ask you guys is, if I'm just a regular person out there and I don't have crypto and I don't know much about crypto, but I hear these headlines of ransomware associated with crypto, am I wrong to assume that the majority of crypto is associated with crime and ransomware? Because I think that's an impression that is given to sometimes regular people who don't know necessarily the full details. How do you respond to that, bro?
Well, I'd respond to that by explaining to them that a majority of crypto is used as a financial product that people want to buy and hold in anticipation of making a return on their investment. If you look at the cash flow into crypto over the last, call it 3-4 years, a majority of the people buying cryptocurrencies are financial institutions that are just creating positions in crypto. There's really few people that actually use crypto for the purpose of spending money, so to speak. I mean, I don't know how often you guys actually spend Bitcoin in your daily lives versus put things on credit card or use cash, but like
all the time if I can.
That's great. And it's like I'll use it occasionally. I for more novelty than anything personally. I mean, there's certainly not an anonymous factor to it. So it's just like if I go to a website, like it all just depends. But the point to your question would be a very small percent of Bitcoin is used for malicious reasons. It's from the beginning of my history with crypto, which goes back 8 years, there's always been a emphasis on the negative attributes of what's going on with crypto. And I used to say this back in like when I would speak on crypto in the early days of 2013, 14, I'd speak at events on crypto And I'd say, you know what's so frustrating about the headline of like the $600 million hacker, or back then whatever the hack was, is you never hear headlines about how Bitcoins help connect and raise money for this local charity like in Africa, and all the positive things that were coming out of Bitcoin in its early existence. And even to this day, there's so many things crypto does in a positive light, but obviously those aren't the type of stories that news organizations are going to write about, because they're just not going to generate interest nearly to the degree of a $600 million heist, which just gets so much more attention. So yeah, people that look at Bitcoin or are a regular person and they don't really spend a lot of time reading about crypto, and then they come across some of these negative stories that go on, like, that's absolutely part of the world in crypto, but it's a small part of the world. And really, Bitcoin's just a new form of payment. So the same way people wouldn't form an opinion around cash if they all they heard was stories about how cash is used for money laundering and buying drugs on the streets and illegal gambling organizations, it's like that wouldn't stop you personally from still using cash in your everyday life, even if other people in the world are using it for nefarious reasons. And the same thing's very true with crypto, which is, yeah, there's maybe a small percentage of people that are using it for evil, but it's a tool, and any tool can be used for good or evil. You know, the internet, there's so much evil on the internet. I mean, don't even get anybody started on it, but that's not going to stop everybody in the world from using it for everything. So I don't know why it's become kind of a thing with crypto that people are like, yeah, but it's only used for bad things. Only crooks use it.
It's just a headline thing, yeah. Right?
I agree. It really is just like the whole, like, if it bleeds, it leads. And they got to report on the negativity.
I got so excited about crypto for the exact kind of things you're talking about, right? I tutored somebody in computer science that didn't even tell me their real name. Somebody in Europe that just needed help with like a crypto-related college course they were taking. And they paid me, and I was able to receive it without any trusted intermediary, without having to know anything about the person that was paying me. The ability to tip artists and, you know, do international remittances if you're a migrant worker or something like that. I mean, those are the things. The point that I wanted to make, right, is people hear the FBI is mad that they can't break the encryption on an iPhone to learn more about how a person carried out a terror attack, right? This encryption thing must be used for terrorism all the time to hide their things. But in reality, every single one of us who has ever logged into a bank account online or used an iPhone or an Android phone uses encryption every day to protect our own personal information, right? But there's no headline to say, Josh left his phone somewhere in public today, and the person who found it couldn't look at his personal photos. Mm-hmm. There's no interest there. But terrorists used encryption to hide information about their motives and attack from the police is a very juicy and interesting headline. I always go back to the fact that, much like anything else, I mean, cryptocurrency, encryption, you know, strong two-factor authentication, these are, as you said, Brooks, they're just tools. And they're tools that can be used for good or evil. But I always take the perspective as a technologist that these things are really powerful. And what they do 99.9% of the time is protect people's privacy, empower people to learn and interact in interesting ways, and not really do money laundering or other sorts of crime. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is an interesting question, Jeremy, because we tend to hear a lot about the bad.
For sure.
Yeah, for sure. One thing I want to point out, and this kind of goes back to the article that I wrote in 2014 on this, is for lesser developed countries that have corrupt governments and overzealous taxation, you know, countries like Venezuela, Rwanda, other countries in the Middle East, cryptocurrency actually is a way for people to, you know, get food and to have financial transactions because the government is so abusive, corrupt, and the costs are so high and burdensome for them to transact in the currency in that environment. So cryptocurrency really kind of is representing a kind of a voice of a democratic revolution in some countries where you have repressive governments. And, you know, if we look at wars, you know, what happened in World War II, you know, they went around and obviously the German Nazis went around and stole money and tried to take over the banks. And so cryptocurrency takes out the central government, and that gives people a sense of security. So that's one aspect to think about with cryptocurrency. The other thing to think about is if you think about credit cards, you know, I'm a fan of credit cards. I like reward points a lot, actually. So that's kind of why I like credit cards. But there's a lot of credit card fraud.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I'll tell you a little story. I've got a Barclays card, and this Barclays card that I got, I got fraud on it pretty much right away. I'm not going to tell you which Barclays card it is, but Barclays has a bunch of different cards. They're essentially a bank, a UK bank, and they do a lot of cards. So different brands will use them for their own branded card, right? But so I had this card, and I didn't use it much, and then I get this mysterious charge on the card, and it's from some place in Eastern Europe. I'd never been there. And I call him and I tell him, like, this has got to be fraud. I've never been here. What's going on here? Why am I being charged this amount? I think it was, I don't know, maybe $80 or something like that. And so they looked into it, right? And again, traditional finance, you know, there's the regulations and the protections you have that they have to investigate this by a certain amount of time, and you're not liable for things that are truly confirmed as fraud, right? They're responsible for that. But so they looked into it, you know, shut my card down, and I didn't have to pay it. They issued me a new card. They issued me a new card. Okay, so I get the new card. And I open the new card, and I had that new card open for, I don't know, not more than 2 weeks. And the first transaction on that new card is a different fraudulent transaction. And I never took the card out of my house, never used it for any transactions. So what do I think in that situation? That's related to a data breach. Because what's happening in the dark web, all these data breaches out there, you know, the data is stored in the dark web. People can go on the dark web and buy these different data sets, you know, and get different pieces of information from different breaches, and they can kind of piece it together. And they use this piece together leaked data to craft custom, you know, phishing and smishing campaigns to organizations like a Barclays. I don't know that they've had a breach, but I have reason to believe that they did because of what happened to me. The point I'm making is credit cards and traditional finance, there's plenty of scams, there's plenty of fraud, and I don't see any reason why that's going to go down anytime soon. And counterfeiting, you know, and I wrote about this in the article I wrote in 2014, counterfeiting cash, right? So you talk about printer technology. Printer technology is really good. Ink is really good. People can actually emulate, you know, $50 and $100 bills. And they do. And Secret Service is responsible for investigating counterfeiting of currency. So the point we're all making really here is that the format of the exchange doesn't matter as much as the intent of the person. If you want to do bad with cryptocurrency or cash or credit card, sure, bad can be done. But the majority of people who are using it are not doing bad. And it's not fair to lump everybody in to one category. It's just not fair. And this is a new technology. It needs time. It needs time.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think people have kind of come around on the negativity of crypto a lot more when it's been, you know, in the news of like Tesla being into cryptocurrency, and for those that know MicroStrategy, and Elon Musk is like very, you know, obviously he's gone back and forth on it, but I feel like that conversation in terms of people kind of being like, yeah, but isn't it just for like criminals and drug users and extortion is starting to fade a little bit. Like people, like I'm not getting that kind of pushback nearly as much from people when I talk about crypto as I did from people a few years ago. So I think that's just part of like seeing the progression of people accepting crypto is not going anywhere. So I do think that it is getting better, I guess is my point in that regard, that, you know, I think for a lot of people, the question is, do you want to put your money into crypto? And people look at it more from the investment side than the usability side of it. Especially in developed countries like the United States, there's not, I've said this since I've gotten into crypto. We in the United States don't need crypto the same way countries like you mentioned, like Venezuela and these repressed places around. And like, you know, I always told people when I got into crypto back in 2013, the main people using it was Africa. Like that was the number one use case for crypto. And I'd go around and I'd speak on crypto and I'd tell people why I'm like super bullish on the technology. And I'd always get pushback from people just being like, why would we need it? And I'm just like, well, no, we don't need it. Like here in the United States, like we don't need it. But there's lots of places in the world where they don't have banking infrastructure. And they're literally still on a cash-only society because there's nowhere to put your cash safely or trust any company with your money. And now you have this ability to download an app on your phone and store your money digitally through, you know, what at the time was Bitcoin.
Yeah,
I thought was a pretty cool thing. So
just got to say, Brooks, I mean, and Jeremy, that's exactly what got me into it, right? Is it's not a better PayPal for us that have access to privilege banking. It's truly global, decentralized, free, and open money. The way I always put it to people is just like encryption, just like privacy technologies, cryptocurrencies are a technological check to power, right? You know, we had all of that huge conversation about privacy in the wake of what Edward Snowden revealed to the world. You know, so the idea that people should use encryption technologies and take some steps to protect their privacy in a way that makes sense for them. Everybody's use case, everybody's threat model is different. And I view cryptocurrency much in the same way. Is like, you might not need it. Like, I'm not here to sell anybody on cryptocurrency when I talk about it. What I'm interested in is saying, look at how fascinating this is. And look how potentially useful this could be for you or your family or somebody halfway across the world that you've never met in a totally different society, in a totally different ecosystem. That's what makes cryptocurrencies exciting, is for the first time, we have had a choice of, do I use a credit card infrastructure with a little bit more protection, or can I interact in a way that's truly trustless, decentralized, and global? It just gave people another option, much in the way that I think it's good that you have an option between Windows, Linux, and Mac OS X.
Yeah, another point on this is that there is a sect of the economy that is unbanked and or a very limited banking. And that's even here in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge population, but these are people that can't get banking accounts. Maybe they have bad credit. For whatever reason, they don't trust them. For whatever reason, they think they're going to be persecuted. Those people, cryptocurrency is a good alternative. And most of that's in the non-Western, non-developed world. But that's a real consideration with cryptocurrency, is these people that are unbanked. And they don't want to be with the bank, and they get rejected by the bank. And it's not a huge percentage here in the West. It's a much larger percentage outside of the West. So that's an interesting consideration to think about. Mm-hmm. But I want to move to current events. You know, I know we all follow crypto-related current events, but one recent news article that is going to be trending more and more, it came out today. And it came out by CNBC, and it was talking about how the second largest U.S. mortgage lender is going to be accepting payment in Bitcoin. I thought that was a really interesting article, but not terribly surprising considering, like you said, Brooks, MicroStrategy is investing heavily in Bitcoin. Elon Musk, has said that Tesla would take Bitcoin. He's made some contradictory statements on that, but a lot of organizations are signaling that they will or want to accept cryptocurrency for future transactions. So with the mortgage article as the backdrop, Josh, what are your thoughts on current events for companies that are going to be accepting Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in the future and where it's trending?
I'm really excited about it because kind of, what I was hitting at in our last little conversation is personally, I'm most interested in sort of like the day-to-day use case for crypto. Like I got interested in Bitcoin when Bitcoin was still supposed to be a payment method and not just like a digital gold or a speculative investment. Now, obviously, right, markets evolve and a lot of people have pivoted more towards the use of cryptocurrencies as an asset class. And I know that's like, Brooks, what you do a lot of work in. But to me, I'm always really excited when a company takes cryptocurrency. I have bought Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu apparel, laptops, phones, my actual monthly phone bill through AT&T. Anything I can pay for in crypto, I do because I'm interested in kind of increasing that adoption. Jeremy, when you talk so much about, the credit card fraud, right? That's where I see cryptocurrency being a great payments use case is anytime I go to an online store, maybe that I don't know, or I go to a retail store, I don't have to trust them with my credit card information every time I go in. I can just make a secure payment using public key cryptography with Bitcoin. So I'm personally hoping that crypto as a payment mechanism continues to increase in adoption.
Brooks? I second all that. Absolutely. I can tell you, I've had this conversation with a lot of people that know me personally, which is that I am an advocate of financial privacy. And so, it's interesting the arguments. I mean, you mentioned this earlier, Jeremy, in regards to the negative connotations to Bitcoin and crypto and that kind of keeping people out of it. And I've always said that there's a value proposition to crypto, which is why criminals and people that are trying to do bad things use it, because they want to have financial privacy. And then you get the response from people that's like, well, I have nothing to hide. And I love when people say that, whether it's like access to your phone, they're like, hey, the government's listening to all of our phone calls, and people's general response is like, I don't care. I have nothing to hide. They can listen to my phone calls all I want. I'm just talking about stupid subjects like, my pet or whatever, the football game. But to me, I value financial privacy so much so that that's really where crypto comes in. But I would argue we're actually not even there yet as a society, because most online portals that accept crypto payments accept the ones like Bitcoin, Litecoin, Bitcoin Cash, that frankly, if I'm using those as a payment, I'm not doing anything private. In fact, I would argue it's even more public than using my credit card, because if you pay for things online with Bitcoin, you're essentially posting your credit card statement to the internet every single month. At least if I use my credit card, there's only one company that sees what I'm doing with my money. But for me personally, one is too much. And so I constantly strive to, how can we make it zero? And in my real day-to-day life, that would be using cash for everything, because cash is still untraceable as far as I know. But there is absolutely a effort towards removing cash from society and forcing us to use digital payments for transparency. And so then that's when I advocate for cryptocurrency projects that support privacy in their transactions, because then you actually have true financial freedom, that it's like, hey, I can go to this website and pay for something, and I can do it in a way. Or for example, I can just send Josh $100 and he and I can do that without the world knowing it. I mean, that to me is kind of what's, and I don't know why I care so much about it, but like if I go get gas in my car, it bothers me that information's like locked in time. Like the big data of the world knows you went to the gas station and bought gas at this time. And that's tracked through your phone data and it's tracked through your financial data. And I really try hard to just minimize my digital footprint. And it's very hard. I mean, I say that to people, even if I turn my cell phone off and I go to the restaurant and want to have a conversation with you, the challenge is everybody else around us has, you know, built-in microphone and web cameras, you know, recording every single thing going on. So, but nevertheless, I still think it's a battle worth fighting, even though it feels like the battle's being lost. And for me, I mean, that's really what gets me so passionate about cryptocurrency is just it's, you know, libertarian freedom of even if it's, you know, talking about smart contracts and we get more into like more blockchain solutions that's not directly involved with just payment. I mean, the ability, you know, some of these cryptocurrency or blockchain projects that are just building out decentralized databases, the value to me of just keeping your data stored in a more secure and decentralized platform than just, you know, how common is it for people that have iPhones just to easily secure everything to Apple's cloud? I don't even know if you're allowed to own an Apple product and not have it tied to their cloud platform because I don't use Apple. But I would say, just pulling a number out of my thin air, that 95% of people that use Apple products store all their data on Apple's servers. So they're giving them access to all of their photos, you know, all of their information. They wear the Apple Watch. Now they're giving them all their biological information. And Apple's collecting all that information. And I just think it's a terrible thing. So that's, to me, where cryptocurrencies really play their biggest value proposition to me is just the libertarian side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Totally makes a lot of sense. And some of the things that you're getting at around data collection and privacy kind of get at these new privacy laws, you know, around the ability to opt out and this GDPR concept, which is coming out of the EU. If you're doing business in the EU, there's additional compliance restrictions around data and things like that. But we all know a little bit about history, and we know that, you know, abusive governments and warlords have, you know, used data to persecute people. And if you can have privacy, you know, let's just say you're in the middle of World War II, and you know, you wanna fund a candidate who is, you know, going to challenge, you know, the abusive Nazi regime. Well, if you want to do that, you probably want privacy, because if you don't have it, they'll probably find you and kill you. And this scenario has happened throughout most, if not all, war conflicts, you know, at all stages of technological development. It doesn't matter what type of technology. Privacy, there's a time and a place for privacy. And everybody isn't entitled to know everything. And that's the real value of cryptocurrency, is that you do have privacy with the better of the coins. But we've been talking to Brooks Clifford of Bidwell Investment Group, a cryptocurrency fund and a tech leader and enthusiast. And we've been talking to Josh McIntyre of Chaintoots, a cryptocurrency education and security YouTube channel, which is widely reviewed. I'm going to make sure to link out both of these great resources to all you listening. I, of course, am your host, Jeremy Swenson of Abstract Forward Consulting, where we interview thought leaders in security technology and process improvement. And we try to shine a light on the tools and tactics that are going to improve security and operational efficiency, breaking the corporate bureaucratic status quo, which plagues many of the organizations that we've talked about. We're coming up to the end of a really great and interesting show. And as we do that, I'd like to let both of our esteemed guests just give their final thoughts, final five pieces of advice or foreshadowing of where they think cryptocurrency is going in the future. So I'd like to start with you, Josh.
Well, I can say this. I am very positive that cryptocurrency is here to stay. And like all great and useful technologies, it's going to evolve. So, you know, it's going to change from what we see now, but I think it's going to continue to be very useful and powerful technology, just in the way that the internet is, just in the way encryption is, and you know, operating systems and all of the technologies that we use to kind of empower ourselves and each other to do whatever we want to do. I think the most important thing to talk about right now in cryptocurrency, just like in the days of the early internet, is really security and best practices. I think we as an industry need to continue to do better about educating each other, building good user experiences, and helping people use this technology safely. Just like in the early days of the internet, when you know we didn't have widespread encryption and secure payment gateways, you know, there were some issues. So we can work as an industry to make it more secure and really get all of the benefits without some of these scams and pitfalls being so common. I'm excited to see where it goes. And, you know, I'm really looking forward to putting out more educational content and just talking to people about this interesting topic, sharing my passion about it.
Such great content you have, Josh, and I'll make sure to share that out as well. I agree with everything you're saying, by the way. Brooks, final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Josh has said. And I can tell you, I'm as enthusiastic about where crypto is today than I've ever been. And there are so many different facets of what cryptography can do in terms of better security for the data that we are producing, as well as the decentralized aspect of bettering yourself and having the information not going through centralized bodies of government. And I'm not just talking about the U.S. government and payment systems. I'm talking about even things just like I was mentioning where, you know, Apple as a governance body holds so much data for people. And I think the more that we can empower ourselves as the people and take the power back is better for everyone. And, you know, there's so many different, you know, politically, there's just so many different things going on in the world right now. And I think so many of them go back to people fighting for freedom and whatever, for whatever, you know, persons of representation they're fighting for. And I feel like I'm making that fight and I'm battling my fight on the financial forefront with cryptocurrencies. And I spend a good chunk of my time, I call it volunteering, which is just trying to help people that are new to crypto get involved in crypto. And that's not necessarily just me managing money and, you know, what I do to pay the bills, but more so just helping people do things the right way, you know, get cold storage devices, learn how to transfer crypto onto cold storage devices, backing up cold storage devices, backing up passwords. And so anyway, I just continue to try to preach for crypto and the positive things that it's doing to improve society. So I will continue to be right here fighting the fight for crypto probably for the next, you know, 10 to 25 years.
Wow. Well, thanks so much to both of you for being on my show. You've got great skill set. We've had a great conversation. And I truly hope that our audience has taken away some nuggets of information and they can find your respective organizations in the links in the show notes. Thanks again.